we're absolutely delighted to have Roger Penrose here to kick off today's session. The title is Spin Networks, Twisters, Cosmology, and All That.
You might wonder what those topics have to do with each other, and what they have to do with non-commutative geometry. I won't tell you the last, because that's what I'm hoping people will tell me. It's basically a rambling talk about things which I've done various stages of my life, having to do with the nature of quantum space-time. So that's really what it's about, is three different angles on... That's really the title, I suppose. Three different angles on quantum space-time problem. And I'm going to start with spin networks, say something about spin networks. This is something I did a long time ago when I was a graduate student. And it's been taken up by people in the loop quantum gravity community. But what I'm going to talk about will be the original version of spin networks and the underlying ideas. But basically, it's based on discreteness and combinatorial rules. So it's a completely combinatorial system. The continuum doesn't appear anywhere in the description. But it's based on the basic rules of quantum mechanics as applied to, in fact, ordinary Euclidean geometry. And then there's twister theory, which I started... to some degree, it was a development from spin networks, although it had many motivations, and I'm going to concentrate on some slightly different motivations, but it had to do with trying to generalize spin networks from the discussion of the rotation group in three dimensions, so one's looking at space, basically, to a space-time description, where one had the Poincaré group and things like that. So I'll say something about that. And then finally... See, these are all to do with what the nature of quantum space might be. Of course, people tend to think of the relevance of this topic to be quantum gravity one's talking about. And quantum gravity, one of the main places one expects quantum gravity to make its impact is on the nature of space-time singularities. We have in the classical theory, Einstein's theory, singularities in which the normal descriptions of space and time go wrong, and one of the driving forces behind trying to find a quantum gravity theory has always been to try and resolve this issue of the singularities and how one describes the physics which is going on. But if one really looks out at the universe and tries to see what nature herself does in relation to these space-time singularities, there's some very strange things which don't seem to have much relationship to any serious version of quantum gravity that I've ever seen, although maybe some peripheral, but anyway, the main point I want to make here is time asymmetry and what's the difference between the Big Bang here and the various singularities. The red things here are singularities. The singularities in black holes, which have a completely different character. So there seems to be some time asymmetry fundamental to whatever's going on in quantum gravity, because these are the places where one expects quantum gravity to be playing its role. I've been banging on about these things for many, many years, but I have a different take on this, which is only very recently, I talked about it, a version of it at least, just about not quite a year ago here, at the Spitalfields conference in November, I've been thinking about it quite a bit more since then. But what one finds is that the quantum geometry at the Big Bang, well, one doesn't really know, but one can make a good case that whatever is going on there is very remarkably mild with regard to what it does to space-time. And I'll say something about that. Conformal geometry seems to be perfectly well defined. It's very different from what happens at the singularities in black holes. And one has to come to terms with this difference. So let me leave this slide up here and say first something about spin networks. Now, these are really three topics, each of which would require a whole lecture. So I'm going to give you a very rapid route to these three topics. first of all, spin networks. And as I say, this is the original space version of spin networks that I'll be talking about. And we have these graphs where the line segments in the graph are to represent entities, well, let's say a self-contained entity. You can think of it as a particle, but it could needn't be a particle. It could be an atom or but something that you think of as self-contained. And it has a total spin. The only thing I'm going to be interested in is its total spin. And this total spin is nh bar over 2. So n is an integer, or it's a natural number, 0, 1, 2, etc. And there is nothing directional about this. This point I want to make, I was interested in this. One of the original motivations for this had to do with Marx's principle. I had long discussions with Dennis Sharma when I was starting to get interested in physics in a serious way, and he was trying to impress upon me the importance of some version of Marx's principle. And so I was led to thinking, what happens, well, if there was only one electron in the universe, for instance, how would it know which way it's pointing, and that sort of question. And the idea would be that at this sort of primitive stage, you don't have any notion of direction at all. You simply know this, you're allowed to know this integer piece of information. And the idea is to try and build up a geometry of space simply knowing these integers and the combinatorial rules that they satisfy. So let me describe the system, spin networks, I'll go through it very rapidly without proving anything, really. First of all, you have not just these line segments, but you have nodes, vertices, and I'm supposing that they're always trivalent. This is a difference between what people in the loop quantum gravity theory area have. They like to have four valent vertices. Then you have complications about you have to put in another piece of information. But if they're trivalent, it's completely fixed. And what one has is that the sum of these integers has to be an even number. There are two basic local rules. It has to be an even number, and secondly, there's a triangle inequality basically satisfied by these things here. And you can consider spin networks, that is to say you have a graph which has built up out of these trivalent graph with numbers attached, natural numbers attached to the edges, and satisfying these rules here.
Money seems to be an
important thing, not letting these things slide down. So that's what those are, I suppose. Two different, no. Okay. Now, any closed spin network, you could have spin networks which have loose ends, or you could have spin networks which are closed. And if it's closed, it has a thing which I'm going to call its value. The value is an integer. It could be negative or positive, but it's a well-defined number. There is a question of orientation, and I fix the orientation by imagining it drawn on the plane, and the orientation is determined by how you draw it on the plane. But the actual rendering on the plane has no real significance. It's really just a total orientation for the whole graph, which is needed as well, so as to determine the sign of this thing here. And I'll tell you how to do this, how to work out V, if you know this spin network, shortly, but let me just say there is a way, for the moment, let's just say there is a way of working out this integer given the spin network, closed spin network, and the orientations given by this particular rendering on the plane. Now, any open or closed spin network, and let's say an open one, has a thing called a norm, which is obtained from the value. And the norm, I've just given an example here, you have your spin network, which I'm supposing is open here. You draw it on the plane here, and you reflect it through a line. So you put down its mirror image here, just reflected in a line, and join up corresponding lines. And then you take the modulus of the value of this closed graph. The norm is now a natural number, which is obtained from an open or closed any spin network. Okay. Now, having that, you can then work out probabilities by the following rule. It's a probability formula. And let's suppose we're given a spin network, which is an open one. It has a number of lines coming in. But you've got two in particular. and I'm going to consider doing an experiment which involves combining these two, and then there are different alternatives for what the third one will be, consistent with these rules here. So let's suppose these are A and B, the value, the spin numbers of the two ends that are we're thinking about here. And let's suppose they come together, and we have now a third one. And so there will be various probabilities of the different possible outcomes of that, consistent with the rules that I've given you there. And that is simply obtained out of by the norms, by the following formula. If you know how to work out the norms, then you can work out the probabilities. It's simply the norm of the one with the C on it times the norm of C by itself divided by the norm of this one, the original one, times the norm of that trivalent vertex there. And that is the probability. And these simply come from quantum mechanics. There's no changing the rules here. It's quantum mechanics. And I just, in fact, these two things here you can work out explicitly. And if my memory serves me correctly, and I have to be relying on it a bit here because I did this rather hastily last night, or early this morning, I should say. And the norm of C is this, and the norm of the trivalent vertex is that formula there. So we have, we can work these out explicitly, but these things can be complicated. It depends how elaborate the spin network is here. Now, I haven't told you how to work out the value. That's the only thing really that's missing in this description. Once I tell you how to do the value, then you can work out the norm, and then you can work out how to do the probabilities. The value is obtained in the following way. I'm really just going to give you some examples. It's just easier to do it this way rather than explain in detail. Here we have a particular spin network, and I've just done it for this case, and you can see what the general answer is. What you do is you look at the numbers on these lines here, and you draw a picture where you have two strands here for that two, and three strands there for that three, and four strands there for that. And I'm dividing by this product of factorials, where there's one factorial for each of the numbers that you see here. And the black line going across is an anti-symmetrizer. So if I see a black line across two of these, it just means straight across minus crossed over. And for three of them, it's just that anti-symmetric combination. And finally, well, you see, for each one of these, you have to expand each of these out. And so you will have factorial n for each of these numbers here all multiplied together. So there are going to be a lot of terms if you work these all out in a reasonably complicated graph here. There are lots of tricks for making that number easier to calculate, but I'm not going to tell you any of the tricks at the moment. That's a refinement on what I'm saying here. But if you take any one of these terms in this expansion, it will consist of a number of closed loops. And you assign to each of these closed loops the number minus 2. And then it'll be a power of minus 2 for each term, but there'll be a whole lot of terms. And in fact, you can prove it's an integer, even though you've got these factorials on the bottom. It's always an integer. And here's some examples that if you have a closed single line of a spin network with a number on it, that it's one more than the number is the answer to that. These things I call strand networks. You could think of them as sort of underlying the spin networks, and these things are in a certain sense more primitive than these. It may look rather mysterious, all these minus twos and all that stuff. I should explain that it has, there's a way of looking at this which is slightly unconventional, which is to think of this as the orthogonal group in minus two dimensions. It's actually the more of the symplectic group in plus two dimensions, which one's doing, but you have an awful nuisance with these things with signs. If you do it directly, you see it's SU2 you're talking about. It's just the rotation group, basically. But you think of that as O minus 2, and that's what this is doing. This is the well, I'm not going to explain where these come from specifically. I just thought I'd give you the rules, and that's sufficient to tell you how to work anything out in principle. Now, the sort of punchline of this subject is what I refer to as the geometry theorem. And the idea here, you see, everything is simply integers. You don't have any notion of direction. How do you get directions out of this scheme? Well, the idea is that if you have some complicated spin network with two, let's say, big lines coming out here. When I say they're big, the numbers A and B are taken to be large. So you think you can keep two cricket balls or something. And they're spinning in some way. And you want to know what is the angle between the directions of spin. Well, you can do this by a following experiment. Let's remove that one for the moment. Following experiment. I'm going to take, say, an electron off one of them and stick it on the other one. And let's say that taking it off this one has reduced its spin value by one. And either sticking it on the other one, it could either increase its spin value or reduce its spin value, depending upon the angle. So if you knew what this probability was, you could work out what the angle between the axis of rotation of those two bodies is. Well, that's fine, except that it's a mixture of two different things here, and it doesn't actually work quite as I've said it, because you might, for example, have two things there which might be no connections whatsoever between them. And this really means that you're not talking about an angle here, you're talking about ignorance. If you think in terms of density matrices, it's really, the thing is, density matrices involve two kinds of probability. They involve the probabilities of the sort of ordinary classical kind, and they involve quantum probabilities, and they're mixed together. And they're all nicely combined in an appropriate way in a density matrix. But here, one's really wanting to know what the quantum mechanical part is, because the ignorance part is getting confused with the quantum mechanical part, and it's not really telling you an angle. So what you have to do is to try and get rid of the ignorance part in the following way. So what you do is a repeated experiment. We do it first. You have these two bodies. You take an electron off one of them, stick it on the other. The spin might go up or down. And then I repeat this, do it a second time. My thing is, if this were a question of ignorance, then the second time, the result of the probabilities would be affected by the result of the first experiment. See, it's now giving you some if you don't know anything about their spins, then you do the experiment again, that's telling you something about the spins, and so the probability values would be changed the second time. But if they're just great macroscopic bodies, and I take an electron off one and put it on the other, it's not going to make any difference to the second. I mean, okay, epsilon difference, but there's an epsilon hanging in the background with all this discussion. I'm not going to worry about that detail here. So that's the idea. And you say this somehow this angle or this probability is stabilized if it really is a quantum mechanical probability. Okay, so that defines the angles. Probabilities due to angle if they are not ignorance, if the probabilities in the second experiment are not affected by the result of the first experiment. Now here's the theorem. The theorem is that if these are quantum mechanical angles defined this way, then the geometry that you get of these angles is basically the geometry of directions in ordinary three-dimensional Euclidean space. So that you get, in the limit of big complicated spin networks, the geometry of three dimensions coming out. And there are lots of puzzles about that. I worried about this for a long time because there's nothing directional about this originally, you see. The geometry that you get out in the end is intrinsic to the system itself. It's not as though...
What is a precise statement? The statement is that you can embed it in a Euclidean space.
Yes, that would be a...
Facefully.
Yes. That's right, yes. But the angles, you can embed it.
Right.
Yeah, that's right.
Do you know that you span all of ordinary
space? Yes, that's true. That's another point which has to be made, absolutely right. That you have to consider... how do you build up three dimensions? Because you start with something which looks planar in a sense. You've only got real.
But okay. So you mean you can show that you cannot embed in two space, but you can embed in space.
Absolutely right. That's right. Yep. So you definitely do get the three dimensions. Okay, so that's basically the original version of spin network theory. There's no gravity in this at all. it's just geometry and how you have systems combining with each other according to the rules of representation theory of the rotation group in three dimensions. And ultimately, you get these directions out again.
What you're saying is that if we look at the combinatorics of spins, we recover three-dimensional.
Yes. Yes, that's right. Exactly,
as combinatorical data.
That's right. Yes. But there's no
there is no direction, of course. Yeah. Just the spin. I mean, just
that's right. It's just spin. There's no. Right. See, the thing that worried me about this is it's Euclidean space. It's the directions in Euclidean space. You don't get distances.
Sure. Yeah, but I mean, if you have angles, you are not very far from getting distances.
Yes. Yes. Well, I.
Yeah, you are.
Yes. Yes. Well. Okay. That's really. How am I doing with the time? Okay, well, that's about a third of the time. I want to move on to twisters, because see, that one of the motivations behind twister theory was how do you do this in four dimensions, you see? How do you get a time as well in the picture? And the sort of obvious thing to think of is how do you, you work with representations of the Poincaré group rather than representations of the rotation group. But then you have this problem that you've got two problems, actually. One is the non-semi-simplicity of the Poincaré group, which makes the representations much more complicated. And the other related issue, which is the non-compactness of the Poincaré group. Now, I thought about this for a while and concentrated more on... I worried about the non-semi-simplicity of the Poincaré group, and thinking that maybe one should, rather than looking at Poincaré group, one should look at the conformal group. Because the conformal group, although it's non-compact, it does have infinite dimensional representations and so on. Nevertheless, it's at least a semi-simple group, and so that was one of the motivations underlying twister theory. However, as far as it's gone, twister theory has never come back to being a combinatorial structure. So this has always been a sort of conflict in my own mind. On the one hand, the feeling that one needed discrete things, that the root physics should be combinatorial discrete. And on the other hand, I've always been incredibly impressed by the power of complex analysis. And I had the feeling somehow these things may be dual to each other in some way, but these are sort of ideas in the background of twister theory. So let me say something about twister theory. In fact, I want to give you one of the other motivations behind twister theory. One of the other motivations behind twister theory is non-locality. Now, people usually talk about non-locality in terms of Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen, and you have very distant objects which can be entangled, telling us that quantum theory is in some sense non-local. But there's a much more primitive non-locality. I confess that it took me ages to realize the thing I'm going to tell you now. It's more primitive than EPR, and to encompass EPR into twister theory is much more difficult. I hadn't realized that the following is much more direct, and I'll come to this at the end. Here we have a simple quantum mechanical experiment. There's a source of a quantum particle here. Let's suppose there's some mirror, parabolic mirror or something, and there's a screen some long way off here. Now, the wave function spreads out here, and the non-locality I'm referring to here is that this wave function determines the probability of finding the particle at the screen in various places, but the non-locality arises because detection at some point here, suppose you find that the particle is here, that almost instantaneously tells you not to find it anywhere else. And this is if you thought of this as an ordinary wave in a pond or something like that, then with a local disturbance here, well, then finding it here, there could be some probability of finding it here, but the probability of finding it somewhere else would be completely independent of whether you find it here or not. And so that's a very fundamental non-locality for single particle in quantum mechanics. So it's already at the one particle level one has this non-locality. Now, I'm going to come back to that. You see, if it was some local phenomenon, you would have superluminal communication. Now, twister theory is basically motivated, as I say, generalizing spin networks and all that. There were about a dozen different motivations in it. I'm only going to refer to two, which I quite often talk about. And one is the non-locality that I've just said over there, and the other is holomorphicity or complex structure. And one of the things that always struck me about space-time, and people seem to be string theorists have always taken a different philosophy here, at least they seem to have, which is my point of view is that space and time, okay, time is one dimension, space three, and this is very tied up with holomorphic structure, with the light cone, in fact. If you look out at the universe, and here we have a number of stars, what you see, of course, that's the celestial sphere, you see this sphere, and it has this particular property in relativity theory that the transformation from one observer to another, so you can have two different people situated at this point, moving with great speed with respect to each other, looking out at the same sky, and they will see the transformed sky, but this transformation is of a particular kind, it's conformal, and this it's conformal, it tends circles to circles, which suggests that one might look at this as the Riemann sphere. So this is one of the basic things of twister theory. One says, okay, you're looking at this complex geometry coming about from here, and also maybe we'll have some non-local characteristics. So let me just give you a rapid picture of the subject. Here we have, coming from this now, you see the idea is to think of the light rays as more primitive than the points. And so here we have a light ray in space-time. I'm just talking about Minkowski space-time for the moment. And here we have a light ray represented by a point in some other space. And if you want to discuss a point in space-time, you think of the family of light rays through it. And that gives you this Riemann sphere in this space, which I'm calling Pn, representing the light rays. Now, if this is a complex space here of one dimension, you would like to think maybe the whole space could be a complex space. Well, it can't be as it stands because it's five-dimensional, and five is an odd number, and odd numbers of real dimensions can't be complex manifolds. It's got to be an even number. Well, let me not be too disturbed by that for the moment, but just to point out these dimensions, that here we have the dimensions indicated. That's four-dimensional space-time, that's right. And the light rays give you a five-dimensional family. And how do you do it? Well, I'm using these space-time coordinates, and those are complex coordinates. For the twister, the basic formula is this incidence formula that I've got at the bottom here. Incidence over here means that the point lies on the line here. Incidence over here means the Riemann sphere contains the point. And the translation from one space to the other is given by this incidence relation, which you can interpret in either space. And you can see what locus over here corresponds to what over here and vice versa by simply holding one or the other thing fixed in this formula. The thing at the bottom is a condition that necessarily holds in order for you to be describing a real space over here. If these red coordinates are real, then there necessarily follows this relation here. And this relation is a Hermitian relation on the four complex coordinates here. It's also just the ratios we're interested in here. So what we have really is a picture here, and I'm going to remove something so as to make it look a little better. Take that one away, yes. Here's a more complete picture. We have a complex manifold here, which is in fact a complex projective free space, and these now really are Riemann spheres. They're projective lines in this space here, but there is a subspace which describes the real geometry, as opposed to complex geometry. If I did the complex Minkowski space, I would forget about this Pn. But for real geometry of Minkowski space, I need to consider this submanifold, and its equation was given on this previous transparency here. It's a Hermitian condition there. So you have one real condition to tell you where this Pn is. Signature plus plus minus minus. Now, I'm not sure what I should... There are various transparencies which I can flash up at you. I'm not asking you to follow the details in the formula. That's just... I haven't got time for that. I really only want to make one point. and this one point has to do with a non-locality. But what one finds is that, and don't bother about the details here, what one finds is that the Zs in this picture, the Zs that I've been talking about here, the Zs I'm talking about here, can be related to the angular momentum and momentum of a massless particle. And the details are on this slide, but let me not worry too much. There's an explicit formula, which I mean, I've used the notation of two spinners and so on, so let me not too worry. But you could, if you know about these things, you can stare at. I can, can't stare at them both at once. Oh, yes, you can. If you look at the ceiling, I'm not sure. Anyway, they're more or less there. But as I say, don't worry about the details. However, the following detail I would like you to worry about, especially people in non-commutative geometry. I may say that I know very little about non-commutative geometry, but if you want to talk about quantum twister theory, the crucial thing is that the twister and its complex conjugate, notice that the index is up or down depending upon whether it's a complex conjugate or not. This means that the Hermitian expression, which I briefly wrote down, let me put that on the other side. This one is being invoked. When one goes to the complex conjugation, you go to the dual space. So that's what's going on here. It turns out, incidentally, that the helicity of the... You can relate the Zs directly to the momentum and angular momentum of an object in Minkowski space by an explicit formula, and the helicity is the norm. So that you can describe things which are not necessarily light rays, but something... I'll just explain this picture I had here. I'm afraid I'm jumping around a bit, but the notice that the original picture had light rays represented as points on PN, but you can also talk about points which are not on PN to give the full complex space here by allowing the photon, if you like, to have helicity. So that gives you an extra parameter. I should say the parameter is really the energy. You fix the helicity to be plus or minus 1, plus 1 up here and minus 1 there, and then the other parameter is the energy or the wavelength, which or the frequency, which gives you the extra dimension that's needed in order to get you up to 6 dimensions. But I'm afraid these things would need to be done in much more detail if I was to explain it properly. You then find that this thing's polarized and so on. But you do have these non-commutative relations, which I would be very interested to see how this develops into some form of non-commutative geometry.
But what is motivation to write down that specific relation?
It came really from what you do in ordinary physics.
Yes.
You see, the motivations came from... There is a leap of logic. It's not completely forced. It's almost completely forced. But it's...
You mean it's like quantizing by multiples of h bar nu or something like that?
It's related to the standard commutation rules of...
So I mean, what you want is to quantize the absolute value square of some...
Yeah, that's right, yes. And then
you use Dirac, A star A.
That's the sort of thing, that's okay. Right. There's a phase, if you like, which is not fixed, knowing that.
No.
But everything else is, and so why do anything else? But I should, just to be quite honest, there is that extra piece of information which is not forced from this, but it's almost forced.
Right. And then you want to look at the real piece? I mean, you still want to look at the equation defining the real...
No, because I'm interested in...
The complex thing.
That's right.
One more parameter.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Because after all, these things can have helicity.
Sure.
And that fits in with the real world.
Right.
Yeah. But one has these commutation rules, which are very basic to twister theory. Mm-hmm. Now... what shall I move over to? I'm afraid I'll have to rattle through these things, as I say, but let me just sort of flash them at you. Suppose you want to describe a twister wave function. Well, since the Zs and Z bars are conjugate variables, a wave function ought to depend on only one or the other, but not both. Now, what does it mean for f of z not to depend on z bar? Well, it means d by dz bar is naught. These are the Cauchy-Riemann equations, so it's telling you that f is holomorphic. So you're really concerned with holomorphic functions when you're talking about wave functions. And if you're interested in helicity eigenstates, this calculation here is just to tell you you're looking at homogeneous functions. So holomorphic, homogeneous, means you're talking about wave functions of a particular, for a particle, a particular helicity. Okay. And then how do you, well, if you didn't know about twister theory, you'd perhaps write down equations like these. These are the massless field equations for different spins, different helicities. And how do you write those things in twister form? Well, you write down in contour integrals, which I've read. Is that a better I think this one gives you a bigger, most more picture, doesn't it? So I'll leave that one there. And these are just the various wave functions. That one is just a complex kind of this, so I'll put that up there. And you can see the homogeneity degrees over here in the twister function, and these are the helicities in the ordinary physics description. But the point I'm making here is that these things are contour integrals, and contour integrals, you can vary your contours and you can vary your functions in complicated ways, and it took me a long time to realize what was going on here. Michael Atiyah was a great help in creating the appropriate understanding, but what emerged is that you're really talking about cohomology. So I'll give you a picture here. So that in fact you can think of this as it's a check picture here where I have the I haven't explained why I'm looking at just the top half of twister space. This has to do with making your wave functions have positive frequency. So to make them proper wave functions, you need to incorporate the positive frequency condition, and this is done very nicely in twister theory by simply looking at the top half of twister space. These are details which I'd it would take too long to explain fully, but basically one is looking at Czech cohomology, which I described over here. Now, it took me an inordinate length of time to realize something very simple, which is that the non-locality that's described here is very much what's happening here. You see, twister theory is non-local at a sort of elementary level, because one's talking about light rays instead of points, and light rays, after all, are not local in space-time. But there's a more subtle non-locality, which comes about because you're really talking about cohomology in your description of wave functions. Now, I find that there is a nice way of saying this, which you can explain to people who don't know anything about cohomology, and so let me do it. And then I want to say what it's got to do with this picture here. I could use that, yes. That's why we really need three transparent projectors. Now here you see is a nice illustration of cohomology. I thought of this when I was a long time ago. I was involved in a television program, and I was trying to explain twisters, and they said, "Well," I said, "Well, it's something to do with cohomology," and they said, "Well, what's that?" You see, it was like that. There's no way that you can explain that to a general audience. And then I thought about it for a bit and said, well, maybe there is, you see. So why is this cohomology? Well, you see, the cohomology I'm talking about is a precise non-local measure here of the degree of impossibility. And you see, if I cover up part of this picture, it becomes possible. So that the degree of impossibility is a non-local thing. And you can give a very appropriate Czech description of this thing. I can do it here, you see. Here we have, you break your picture up into three pieces, and each one of these represents an object, and then you have to have some patching to tell you how to glue it together. And this patching is, well, the logarithm of the distance from your eye is that gives you an additive thing. And there's you can construct a cohomology element from these different Czech things here. And the non-vanishing of that cohomology element is telling you the degree of impossibility. So it is cohomology. You see? So this is a way of saying what it means. Okay, now what's that got to do with this? Well, you see, you're sort of, the cohomology here is of a very nice and simple kind. These are basically just real numbers you're talking about. It's not really sheaf cohomology, even. It's very simple. But in complex analysis, you have to worry about something a little more subtle, but it's the same sort of idea, and you get right driven into this thing here. But you see, this is where you're driven when you use a twister description of a wave function. And it's a wave function of a single particle. So here, you see, okay, the wave function here is not some local quantity which tells you a number at different places. It's this cohomological entity. In twister space, it's a cohomological entity. And the measurement somehow ties it into something else. And it sort of breaks it. And once you've broken it somewhere, it's gone. And so you're not going to see it anywhere else. So this seems to me this notion of a cohomology element encompasses the non-locality that one sees here. Anyway.
Well, Roger, I mean, you know, you are a little bit vague here, because what I mean is that there is the measurement process.
Yes.
You have to tell us, in your mind, where is the measurement process?
Yes. It doesn't solve that problem at all.
No. But I mean, gives you an analogy in the mind, but okay, then one would have to be more precise.
Yes,
actually,
yes.
Identify the place.
I mean, what I think is that it's to do with when you tie it into gravity and when you have you have non-linearities coming in, and
what you mean is that when you tie it with gravity, there will be a cohomology operation which will take place and which will have exactly this non-local.
Yes, I think that's the way of looking at it. Yes, that's right. Yes. So somehow, when the measurement is taken, you're tying it into something else. It's not a one particle problem anymore, and it's really a quantum gravity problem because there's some displacement of large objects or something involved in it. So that's the idea. Okay, that's all I wanted to say about twister theory. I'm only slightly behind. And let me say something about cosmology. You see, all these things are mathematical schemes. Okay, there's input from physics here. There's input from quantum mechanics in the calculations of spin networks and so on. But it doesn't tell us what nature thinks about quantum gravity. And there's not a huge number of clues about what nature really thinks about quantum gravity, but there are clues. And so what I want to do is put up a picture here of the standard cosmologies as we now understand them. These are the different... I put in a cosmological constant, which, although people call it all sorts of strange things like dark energy... I'm just calling the old-fashioned word cosmological constant because, as far as one knows, this does fit with the observations perfectly well. The alarming thing that there is one, but it's certainly that's not new in the sense that it's in all the cosmology books. It has been ever since Einstein put the number in somewhat reluctantly in 1917. Tried to take it back out again, but you can't do that once a thing's been suggested, then, of course. There it is, just as well, because it seems to be there. So, but let me say something else, though. Here I have the various different spatial geometries, positive curvature, flat, and negative curvature. It doesn't need to make much difference to the pictures. Indeed, it doesn't. But I just want to say something about the negative curvature case. We don't know which it is at the moment. There are certain people say it's flat, but that's not much good, because if it's flat, then there's no reason why it shouldn't be one of these, because, well, there's always a bit of error. There are some observations which seem to suggest it might be, or some interpretations of the observations which tell us that the likelihood is that it's negative. But that's not important, really, what I want to say. What I want to do just for the moment is to remind people of pictures like this. This is actually not an Escher. I couldn't find my Escher just at the last minute. It's a pseudo-Escher done by people at the Mathematics Institute of California. But the point I want to make is this is the Beltrami-Poincaré so-called conformal representation of the projective plane, hyperbolic plane. And you notice that you could represent it conformally, nicely in the Euclidean plane.
Why do you have these added disks in the middle? I mean, they are not...
Those are supposed to be eyes. Don't ask me, I didn't produce that picture.
Because they are not allowed in the Poincaré geometry.
The circles are allowed, so they're...
They should be perpendicular to the boundary.
Oh, I see. No, they're well, I forget the terms. Hypercycles or well, they're not.
They're not orocycles because orocycles.
No, they're touched. That's right. No, these are they're circles.
Yeah.
But you can have circles in.
No,
I'm not going to quibble about that. The only point I want to make here is that in representing the entire infinite geometry in the Euclidean plane, you see, you get all this crowding around the edge here. That's because that's infinity for hyperbolic geometry. Whereas hyperbolic geometry, the infinity is represented very clearly and without any difficulty in the Euclidean plane as a boundary to the hyperbolic space. Just bear that in mind. I should also, though, make this picture somewhat more accurate, not by improving the line quality, but by introducing the singularities of black holes. You see, we have the Big Bang singularity, but we also have local collapses into black holes. And the point that I try to tell people endlessly is that the geometry is completely different here and here. The geometry, you could say this is a low entropy singularity, these are high entropy singularities, and the geometric nature of the difference is, I think, best described in terms of the Weyl curvature, and you can always, I think it's nice to tell people who don't know anything about conformal geometry what the Weyl curvature looks like, because it's the distortion effect due to, on light rays, well, particularly on light rays, and here you have a beautiful picture of distortion due to some object in the middle here, and the distant galaxies are stretched around in this way to give you this, just to the eye, you just look at it casually and you can see it straight off. People, of course, use complicated computer analyses to work out that there is indeed a tendency for the galaxies to be stretched around here. And this is the lensing effect, which is a non-conformal effect on the geometry, and that is a measure, direct measure of the Weyl curvature, or the conformal curvature of space-time. Now, why do I bring the Weyl curvature in? Because you could ask, what is it that's special about the Big Bang? And this is simply observationally. We don't have a theory to telling us, well, that's something I want to say something about. We don't have a theory for telling us what's special about it, but what we do have is we do know that it's extraordinarily uniform, which means that gravitational effects have somehow been suppressed. And the suppression of the gravitational effects in the sense of making the Weyl curvature very small at the initial singularity have the effect of, the Big Bang singularities was enormously constrained to at least one part, or I say to one part in at least 10 to the power 123. Actually, it's probably, this number's a lot bigger than that, but telling you how very, very precise that Big Bang was in its organization. Now, there are various ways of formulating the Weyl curvature hypothesis. I want to concentrate on a particular way of doing this, which is being exploited particularly by Paul Todd, which has to do with, well, actually, let me leave this one here, and I'll go to the other projector. I want to tell you two tricks. One trick, as I've been using for many decades, which has to do with discussing gravitational radiation and by use of a conformal rescaling. So you say here, the G here is the physical metric, and you say you introduce a conformal factor, that is a local scaling of the metric, can vary from place to place, to give you a new metric up to, well, a new metric. These have the same light cones. In Lorentzian geometry, you can say the conformal geometry is equivalent to the light cone structure. And you can use this as a trick to make infinity finite and talk about gravitational radiation and so on. But this is a nice device for discussing gravitational radiation using finite ordinary means of differential geometry. the trick here is to shrink infinity to a finite place by taking this factor omega to be zero out there. So that's the trick. Now, when you've got a positive cosmological constant, as it seems we have, the trick still works. In fact, in a certain sense, it works better. And there are various little problems that one has in the null case, which are removed. You get other problems which are not removed, which are introduced, in fact. But it's some of the more serious problems in this description are removed when you have a positive cosmological constant. The main difference, though, is that you have now a space-like boundary rather than null one. In this picture, this is a light-like boundary, whereas for positive cosmological constant, you get a space-like boundary. So that's trick number one. Trick number two is the sort of inverse of that. How do you treat cosmological singularities? As I said, Paul Todd has formulated the Weyl curvature hypothesis using this trick by saying you now infinitely expand the Big Bang to give a nice conformal boundary. And that's like the picture that we have. Well, this is trick number one, if you like, where the infinity is made finite by introducing a conformal factor which goes to zero at the boundary. The opposite trick is to expand out the Big Bang. Now, there's a crucial difference between these two. One is that the trick number one is basically automatic, especially when there's a positive cosmological constant. If you've got your fields dispersing out to infinity and so on, you can more or less say that there will be a nice boundary at infinity. So that kind of picture is relevant, but in the Lorentzian case. So this happens automatically. The second version, is a huge constraint on the nature of the Big Bang, which is basically the Weyl curvature hypothesis. So trick number one works automatically. Trick number two is a formulation of the Weyl curvature hypothesis. So what this is saying, and here's the proposal, is that the Big Bang is constrained in this way. Quantum gravity, whatever it is something which tells us that, and this is the proposal, it's a hypothesis if you like, quantum gravity is telling us that initial type singularities, the ones in the past, wherever they might be, have to satisfy this condition, that they can be expanded out to be conformally regular. Perhaps I should put this transparency down here. This is just telling us the conformal geometry, the metric up to scale changes, angles and small shapes, but not lengths are preserved. And the thing is, this is 9 out of the 10 components of the metric, which are preserved by these conformal rescalings, leaving the light cone alone. But you have only one parameter, at the Big Bang, you see, everything is regular. The idea is with regard to conformal geometry. This conformal geometry is extendable to something behind. So you see, the mathematical tricks are to say, okay, there is some fictional space-time prior to the Big Bang, which you can extend through, but it's not supposed to be physics. This trick is, okay, there's some fictional space-time beyond infinity, but it's not supposed to be physics. The idea here is to say, whoops, maybe it is physics, you see. So now this is, okay, this is a crazy idea, and I admit it's a crazy idea. Not as crazy as many ideas I've seen in cosmology, so I feel that I'm justified in putting it forward. There are various people who put proposals rather like it. Veneziano has a proposal a bit like what I'm saying here for some years, and Steinhardt and Turok have a proposal which is also a bit like it. But they don't have the same philosophical underpinnings, and certainly in detail it's very different. So the idea here is, okay, conformal geometry is the basic thing, and the metric is a sort of afterthought. So, there's two sort of physical things one says here. One is, okay, what is the remote future likely to be like in this universe? And one of the motivations behind this idea is the thought is how incredibly boring the universe as we understand it is. Because you have this, okay, you sit around and wait for this thing to go up to infinity. Not, it's worse than that, because what interesting things are happening in this universe? Well, black holes are there, and if you wait long enough, they'll disappear by Hawking evaporation. So just imagine sitting around waiting for a black hole to decay. I can't think of anything more boring somehow. So I shouldn't use emotional arguments, I suppose, in physical discussion, but it seems to me it's all right as long as you discard them at a certain point and look at serious observations and so on and so forth. But the emotional argument is that this is incredibly boring, and that's not very nice. But then you still think, well, is it that boring? Because after all, who's going to be around to be bored by it? Well, the only people that are going to be around to be bored by this universe are massless radiation. Well, this is the proposal. There's some physical hypotheses which go into this. The black holes have to disappear. You have to think of some way of getting rid of the electron's mass, which is a bit of a nuisance. But let's suppose that's all right. You end up with nothing but massless radiation. And does a photon get bored? No, because a photon doesn't experience any passage of time at all. In fact, infinity is no big deal to a photon. It just happens. You see, and plop, there it is. So as far as a photon is concerned, the conformal boundary to infinity is just there. I mean, it just whips through. And so, as I said, it's an emotional argument. What about the Big Bang? Well, you see, it's another reason why you might think that conformal geometry was the really appropriate thing. And there it's quite different. There it's the energies get so large that the mass becomes irrelevant, and it's a reasonable hypothesis that the main interactions, if the mass is gone, are also conformally invariant. So the proposal is that you have conformal invariance right near the Big Bang, you have conformal invariance near the infinity, and this tells you that the universe doesn't really know about the metric at that stage, and so it's not an unreasonable suggestion to basically glue them together. So here's the picture I'm having, that somehow this is our universe here, there's the Big Bang, there is eternity, and that's the same because it's lost track of the metric, but conformally it's the same as the Big Bang of a new universe. So you have a previous universe, and it keeps on going like this. So this is the crazy proposal.
But Roger, I thought you had written that the wild curvature will be much, much bigger at the big crunch than it...
Yes. Oh, absolutely. That's why I can't have one. Yes, that's right. If you had a big crunch, this picture wouldn't work. So it's very different.
Oh, it's quite different.
From what people... Yes. Oh,
so it's a picture in which you don't have an increase of the wild curvature.
You don't have... Yes, right. It just... You see, some people have suggested, okay, there's a big crunch and that's the new Big Bang. No. This is the universe expands indefinitely, forgets the metric.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, therefore, it's as a conformal manifold.
It doesn't change.
That's right. It just fits smoothly onto the next one. Uh-huh. Because there is no actual metric here. Now, you need to make mathematics work here.
I understand, but what about your connection between entropy and the wild curvature?
That comes about because there is an infinite rescaling in the metric. But yes, there are important...
Doesn't change the wild curvature.
The wild curvature has to be zero here,
yes,
in order to fit for the space-time geometry. But there is an issue of where the phase space goes. And okay, I see you in 2 minutes. I don't know the explicit answer to this question.
Okay.
I have ideas, and in fact, there's a lot of swallowing of phase space volume due to the black holes. And I think it's connected with the Hawking the difficulty people have about the loss of information.
Yes.
These are two black holes spiraling into each other. And then they send out gravitational waves. Here the gravitational waves go out. And here we have the Hawking evaporation at the end.
Do you mean this swallows wild curvature?
It swallows... It does, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah. It does.
So that's what you mean. You mean the wild curvature evaporates in that?
Yes. Yes. That's right. Yes. Somehow all the gravitational information is swallowed in the hole. I mean, okay, one needs to make sense of all that. And I agree, this is a crucial point. Absolutely. Yes. Absolutely. No, completely. Yes. Now, there are a number of points which need to be sorted out in detail, and that is certainly one of them, one of the biggest ones. So I'm worried about that, and I don't know what answer to suggest. I think the one I favour most is that it is swallowed by the black holes, and that this is, for quite different reasons, I am a believer that the information is lost in the Hawking evaporation process, in the final explosion, but it's not much of an explosion.
Then you could restore a situation which was the same as the one you started from.
Yes, yes, yes. So that ultimately you don't lose information. This, but it needs to be looked at in more detail. Anyway, this is the end of the story, but it's just curious that somehow nature seems to be telling us that quantum gravity, as far as going back this way is concerned, is pretty mild. As a conformal space, and that's 9 out of the 10 components of the metric, it's a perfectly smooth manifold. Okay, it's a different story in the black holes. That's a completely different story. But it's okay, we need some time asymmetry, and it ties in with the measurement problem and various other things in physics, so it's obviously a big topic, but at least this is a scheme to play around with, and I leave you with that thought. And I don't know if I've left any time for questions, but...
There's time.
Yes.
Question. Does that not work if you remove the Big Bang?
Does this not work? Oh, absolutely it doesn't work. No. No.
Make it
fine. We need the Big Bang, yes, yes. And it needs to be a Big Bang constrained in this very particular way that it seems to be constrained.
But if you extend it, what you're basically seeing is the next evolution is the Big Bang. You basically, the Big Bang forms the universe. Yes?
Yeah. Well, it's this universe, you see. The Big Bang here, see, I've tried to draw two things at once. The purple line represents infinity of this universe, and that smoothly, as a conformal manifold, continues into the Big Bang of the next universe.
But if you prove the Big Bang is incorrect, if you eliminate the Big Bang, you've still got the universe.
I need the Big Bang for this model. But it's not quite it's not such bad news, you see. It's a regular region from the conformal geometry point of view.
If you look at it backwards,
yeah.
If you remove matter, yes, if you remove the electrons and you just have radiation,
yeah,
they will congeal to form a black hole.
What, if we go back this way?
If you start it, I look at the term work backwards, because you can flip this diagram upside down and change it.
Yeah, but it has to be, there has to be a time asymmetry in the whole. The physics has to be time asymmetric. It seems to me that's unavoidable.
Talking about that, I mean, by focusing on the bulk curvature, you sidelined the Ricci curvature, and in fact, that's the thing which we know is more controlled by equations that we understand. So,
yes.
How is that? You know, how can you just ignore?
Well, the Ricci curvature, you see, although it's infinite, you see, it's infinite with regard to the metric you use on this side. It's actually zero on this side. But that's the conformal rescaling that goes from one side to the other involves an infinite. Yeah, it produces Ricci curvature.
No,
that's not what you mean.
But how is this going to be consistent with Einstein's equation which controls the Ricci curvature in terms of matter?
Well, the proposal. I can tell you where my thinking is going, but you see, these are still provisional statements. Is that what you want is a conformal formulation of Einstein, and I'm happy to see that in recent observations it seems that dark matter is real. And so one doesn't perhaps have to worry about modifications of Einstein's theory which change the laws of gravity. And so that's rather a relief to me. I'm worried about that for a bit. But if there really is dark matter, okay, we don't know what it is, but that tells us that it's okay for Einstein's equations to be very, very precisely true. And so the proposal here is, okay, you can make that into a conformal theory quite easily. You just introduce a scalar field, the omega, that's here, and putting that scalar field equal to 1 gives you a choice of metric. Letting it vary is another field, but then it's conformally invariant. The advantage of that is you can allow it to be 0. And where it's 0, you can't then get Einstein back again. But you can wherever it's non-zero. Now, I need it not just to be 0, but I allow it also infinity. So it's more like a projective coordinate, which is allowed to be infinity as well. And so you have to have a scheme where that either being zero or infinity is still okay. And that's the only place where you have to go beyond Einstein. So Einstein is precisely right here and here, but here you have to have some more equations to tell you what's going on in the description. But the conformal geometry alone gives you quite a lot of constraints which should give you observable consequences. You certainly get density perturbations, which are correlated in ways that people seem to see, and you don't have any inflation in this model in a certain sense, because the inflation took place before the Big Bang. That's a bit like what Veneziano says in his version. So you can have correlations between distant events on the Big Bang, as the observations seem to indicate. But it's a very classical picture, which some people might find disturbing, because you might think the Big Bang was a good place to see where quantum gravity is playing its role. It's still there because in the little crunches in black holes, you can't get away with doing it this way. Yes?
Roger, in your picture, could we actually observe anything from the previous universe?
Yes.
What?
Well, you see here, I tried to draw in this picture. You see, here we have black holes, these lines may represent colliding, black holes spiraling into each other. They produce gravitational radiation. This gravitational radiation shows up in the Weyl curvature here. Okay, it scales away at infinity, but the zero rest mass field is still there. It has a different conformal factor. On the other side, it's the normal derivative of the Weyl curvature, which you see on the boundary. Not the Weyl curvature is zero, but its normal derivative is not zero. That normal derivative has to carry across. If it's going to be smooth as a conformal manifold, that carrying across introduces density fluctuations in the next stage. So you should be able to see, in the detailed nature of these density fluctuations, what's been going on before. So I don't know how you'd get that information out, but in principle, it's there. Yeah.
I just have one quick question, which is the following. You know, when one writes an action principle that comes from spectral considerations, what one finds the Einstein action,
yeah,
Dilaton, so it's very close.
Yes, okay, yeah.
But there is also a small, very, very small Weyl curvature term, which enters, Weyl square.
I see. Ah.
I was very intrigued from the start by your book, you know, where I was with the Weyl curvature hypothesis.
Yeah.
This is in Euclidean form. But
it can be
shifted back to Minkowski.
Sure.
So I'm very curious to see what would happen, you know, whether one would get a similar picture if one would take that action.
Yeah, so this is conformal gravity, right, basically.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's not conformal gravity.
It's not conformal gravity. You're not taking this.
It has the Einstein term.
Yeah.
It has a huge Einstein term.
Okay.
And it only has a small,
you have an additional
very,
term.
Very small additional term.
I see what you mean.
It's a correction to that.
But it's like the square of the Weyl curvature, right, the additional
it's
term.
An additional square of the Weyl curvature.
That's interesting, yeah.
So I am very curious to see how
that
slightly is. Disturbs
okay.
The Einstein gravity.
That's an interesting idea, yes. Okay, think about that.
Thank you.
I think you're the last one, if you can.
Okay. So I first of all have a small comment.
Yeah.
That it's non-commute, as far as I remember, that non-commute twisters were used in the paper by Kapustin and Verloff to construct non-commute twisters.
Okay.
And the question is, do I understand correctly that there exists a formulation of spin networks in terms of Grassmann variables? Because you always use this
anti-Semitization. I don't know. I mean, of course, these things are... I'm not quite sure how that comes in here. You see, there is a sort of... It's a trick. You just allow and they are Grassmann variables in a certain sense, because if you introduce... when I say that you have minus two dimensions with the orthogonal group, you're only allowed at first sight things which have an even number of indices, if you like. So if you want to introduce vectorial entities, they have to be Grassmann variables. I think perhaps this is related to what you're saying. So you do need Grassmann variables if you wanted to have objects with an odd number of indices. Let's say vectors, trivectors, so on. But just if you have an even number, that's okay. So that you get non-commutative properties there. But what it's got to do with non-commutative geometry, I don't know. But maybe there is a connection.
I think it's just classical fermions which anti-commute.
Yes, that's right, yes.
Yeah, I think we had better cut it short. So let's thank Roger again.